military attaché at Tehran's embassy in Beirut, Ahmad Mutavassilian, along with Iranian charge d'affaires in Lebanon, Mohsen Mousavi, an employee of the embassy, Taqi Rasdiqar Muqaddam, and a photographer for the Islamic Republic Agency, Qasim Akhavan, were abducted on July 4, 1982. Lebanese militiamen from the Lebanese Forces Group admitted to kidnapping the four men who were on a diplomatic mission in North Lebanon. Investigations show that they were last handed over to Israel at the time.
The legal follow-up of this case in the last few years proves without a doubt that these men were kidnapped on a militia checkpoint, and it was proven that they were put in the jails of that well-known militia which was collaborating with the occupation entity. There are testimonies that they were handled over to the occupation forces. The Lebanese government has a responsibility to follow up the case to highest levels, including the International Criminal Court.
Those in attendance called for an objective investigation by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Although there is information about those who abducted the Iranian diplomats and their whereabouts, the fate of these Iranians remains shrouded in mystery. The families and Iranian officials believe they remain detained in Israeli jails. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for 3 straight days. We travelled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill, and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are they doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage.
A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road.
Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier.
A shell pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window. She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window.
Now, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves as they've been incoming here. We heard the explosion a little bit. We're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now, we were going to try and find the woman. The two people killed are relatives of them, but frankly, my team has said we've got to get out of here, as it's just too dangerous.
At the market, the anger amongst people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years, and it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. Three were killed yesterday, five the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Tehran has organized a fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception. Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-liter tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Puriza, London.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the den of espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week. to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lipp, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just, I think, controversial.
That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken 1,600 euros out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. It's, and especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of like hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment and then, from different people like pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat that where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding. The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Might as well be called a political bloodbath. More than 30 ministers have quit Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government. Yet the British Prime Minister rejects calls by the Labour opposition, for example, to call a snap general election. But why are his ministers quitting en masse? Why did they lose such faith in his leadership? Were too many scandals just too much to bear? Or do they believe that Johnson is just not fit to run a country which is going through an economic crisis? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his Health Secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognise over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologise for it. I think in hindsight it was the wrong thing to do. I apologise to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. I like Boris as a friend. I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in freefall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saipur is up, London.
Well, let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Trevor Busby joins us. He's an economic analyst who joins us from London. Also joining us is Mick Napier, activist and commentator who joins us from Edinburgh. Welcome to you both.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Shabir Resmi, if I may. We're looking at the reasons behind these mass resignations that have taken place of rocking the government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And, of course, as you're well aware, it's the Pincher affair, this Chris Pincher, the deputy chief whip who resigned last week. Do you buy the fact that that is the only reason that you're seeing all these resignations?
Hello, good evening. I'm sitting not very far from the parliament at this moment, about 20 minutes away. And really, it's an extraordinary situation that's unfolding here in the last 24 hours. I think really, one's got to look at it in context. It's not that what happened with the Deputy Chief Whip, Mr. Pincher, or the sort of catalogue of Mr. Johnson has been well known to have very little affinity with truth. Historically, when he was the mayor of London or throughout his premiership or prior to it, when he sold the lie of Brexit. One of the MPs recently described in the last 24 hours that they are demoralized, distraught, and disturbed, distressed. I would say that the government has been dodgy, disgraceful, and really disreputable. It's that, you know, the two ministers are resigning, and over the last 24 hours, we've had about 38 ministers and sort of ministers or secretaries of state who have resigned. Not only that, what's fascinating is that his newly appointed chancellor, Nadeem Zahawi, is also lobbying for the prime minister to resign. It's really quite disgraceful. You know, the whole politics in UK, I think we did a commentary about 4 or 5 months ago where I said that the Conservative Party is a winning machine. They really don't care who the leader is, so long as they are in a position to win. So I think the MPs are now realizing, the Conservative MPs are very clearly realizing that to have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister is probably more dangerous for their own well-being as members of parliament. So they're abandoning ship at this moment, and also the former ministers are also looking whether they can also become prime ministers when Johnson goes. I mean, there's a great metaphor in English which says a fish rots from the head down. So obviously it has been rotting for the last 2.5 years, if you like, since Boris Johnson became the prime minister, and it is very clearly becoming that the fish is smelling terribly now, and they have to either get rid of that fish or do something else altogether. And this is where the whole situation arises. As you said in your opening comments, that we've got a crisis taking place where ordinary families are suffering in UK. Nearly 4 to 5 million people go to food banks, and you know, fuel prices up, energy prices up, and the reality is right. that these shenanigans taking place at Westminster do not impact the people when they're suffering economic pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mick Napier, it's really turning out to be a soap opera here, if you really take a look at it in some sense, which is not funny, really. But when you have a chancellor that Johnson elects, and then that chancellor turns against Johnson, what are we looking at here? Are we looking? I mean, there's got to be something bigger picture here that maybe we're not catching on to, in terms of the revolt that's taking place, especially when you have a new chancellor that then turns on the PM. How do you assess the situation?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's soap opera, but if somebody had written the script for a soap opera, it would have been rejected by the director as far, far too improbable. A couple of hours ago, there were 20 ministers and junior ministers who had resigned from the government. Now I think it's just one or two under 40. It's 38 or 39 now. So this is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this in British politics. I think we need to look at the surface and then look a little bit beneath the surface. I mean, at one level, most of the crisis can be self-inflicted. That is, an intelligent and a different kind of leader could have avoided them. You know, the promotion of a sex pest, really, really, what can I say, shocking and horrifying millions of British people who had been unable to say goodbye to their loved ones when they were dying during lockdown because the lockdown was extremely strict. And during this time, Johnson and his friends were ordering people on TV to follow these instructions and then leaving to have a drunken alcohol-fueled party, violating all the rules. That got through to a lot of people at a very visceral level. And I think we're seeing some of the effects of that coming through in the crisis today. You know, all sorts of dishonesty and shenanigans from Johnson. But you know, who could be surprised? He has a whole history of dishonesty, of being fired from jobs, of being caught on television, sorry, of being caught in a phone call, plotting violence against a journalist whom one of his friends was angry at. But I think we do have to go a little bit deeper, because I think most of the Tory MPs are very worried about losing their seats. There are many crimes that they consider Johnson has committed, but they all come under one heading. They could lose their seats. And his only real crime for them is losing elections. And he's losing elections by an unprecedented margin, and they're worried about their seats. But it's not just that. I think we look at some of the key spokesmen for the Conservative Party, and you can see that they're very worried. They're using language against their own leader, which we've never heard before. And I think we have to look at not just losing seats, but the crises that are coming down the road for any government in London.
Sure.
Inflation, strikes, they're preparing for a long drawn out war, a proxy war against Russia. And they feel entering all these crises of a perfect storm mm-hmm. that they need a leader whom they can rely on, whom they can trust, and somebody who will inspire confidence among the population.
Sure.
And Johnson can't do that. So I think taking those two things together, that goes a long way to explaining okay. this soap opera.
We're going to get into some of those issues that you just talked about, really. But this is what Johnson has said so far in terms of the way that he has treated this Shabir Rizvi, and he has said that he has a mandate from the 2019 election to press on. I'm not going to step down. And that's the last thing that this country needs, frankly, is an election. Is it the last thing the country needs, or is it what the country needs?
Sorry, is that for me?
Yes, for you, yes.
Okay, thank you. Look, insofar as elections are concerned, obviously the Labour Party is jockeying to have an election as soon as possible. Whether that happens or not, because within the sort of parliamentary process that we have in the UK, is that a leader can be removed and another leader from the same party can be installed, and he can continue until the next election, which is due perhaps just over 2 years from now. So that's an option that the Conservative Party may want to take, because as our commentator earlier said, that the members of parliament, the 80 majority that the Conservative Party have, potentially a lot of them could lose their seats. So they may want to continue, because as I said, the ethos of the Conservative Party is not ethics, honesty, and all the nice words that Mr. Sunak and Mr. Sajid Javid have used. The reality of the Conservative Party is it's a winning machine. It wants to be in power so that its friends in the city can benefit and the ordinary people become losers. That's the sort of ethos of the Conservative Party. So they will abandon any leader. As I have commented previously, that Margaret Thatcher, who won 3 elections for the Conservative Party over 30 years ago, she was knifed and she was removed while she was Prime Minister. And similar thing happened to Theresa May. Soon after that, Boris Johnson became the Prime Minister because she had a very thin majority to carry on after the election that she called. So the reality is that the Conservative Party may want to put a new face to it, but the tragedy is that in the UK, the Conservative Party has taken the garb of the the right-wing elements in society who are, in a way, very keen for Britain to stay out of the European Union, they're against immigration, and the whole host of racist policies that right-wing parties had, and the Conservative Party has taken that on, which appeals to a significant section of the population in UK. Therefore, if there is an election tomorrow, potentially with a new head of the Conservative Party, the Conservative may potentially win election again, because they're very good at winning elections. The Labour Party doesn't have a leader that can really resonate with the public at this moment. So I don't know whether Labour will win if there's an election, but the reality is that the Conservative Party is willing to abandon a leader as and when required, so long as they can continue to be in power.
Sure. Well, I don't know if this is important or not, but it is, in a sense, where we're looking at another, what are we looking at here? The UK Minister for Industry, Lee Rowley, and 4 other members of the government have resigned. I don't know if you were aware of that. So Mick Knapp here, let's go to the election, the 2022 Executive Committee. They're looking for the rules to change in terms of the vote of confidence, of which, as it stands, it cannot be challenged for another year, and it seems like they will be able to do that. So what direction will this now be taken in terms of how it will affect whether the vote of confidence is going to take place and in what period of time?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's quite useful to look at Boris Johnson as a kind of mini Donald Trump. But the problem for Johnson is that we don't, as our other guest has said, we don't have a presidential system. It's a parliamentary system. And the system now, I think, means that very shortly, Boris Johnson will go. He has a huge majority of his party against him or indifferent. His recently appointed chancellor has just come in the door and has turned on him, taken a knife out, a political knife out of his pocket, and told him that Johnson has to go, which brings Nadeem Zahawi very close to replacing him because he's currently the chancellor. So I think it's impossible for the government to proceed. I mean, how on earth? I mean, you've just mentioned there are an extra four people who've left. It is impossible for anybody to replace 40 odd ministers and junior ministers in the government. So I think the way ahead, just by Johnson insisting on going ahead, has been closed off. If he refuses to go following the meeting taking place now in Number 10 Downing Street, then this 1922 committee has the power to force him to go, simply to vote, and his game is over. And I think that is what's likely to happen.
Oh, it can do that.
It can do that, yes.
That they can vote for Johnson to be force him to resign or take that position away from him?
Absolutely. As soon as they call a vote of confidence and Johnson loses that vote, then he's gone.
Once that vote of confidence is called, when will that happen? I mean, they're going to vote on it to happen, but, I mean, what length of time?
It could happen very quickly. It's within the gift of the 1922 committee to set the rules. They have, and it's not expected to be used very often, but in this critical situation, they will be trying to prevent a situation where Johnson creates a constitutional crisis. They can call a vote, and then he loses the vote, and then he goes.
Very well. Let me bring in Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's get down to business here, because that is what is at stake. I mean, we're looking at the UK economy. We're looking at, obviously, the cost of living crisis, inflation, and the whole host of other challenges, to say the least, and economic crises that the UK is facing. Not that other European countries are not facing. I mean, you need to have a team to handle that. And these are the most extreme circumstances that we're looking at. Forget about the fact that you came out of COVID and you're trying to deal with that, which now you have, obviously, the Ukraine conflict compounding that. How can this happen? How can a team be formed, let alone a leader, to be elected, were Johnson to go, to handle all this?
Well, look, this is the sort of a crucial question that I think the majority of the Conservative members of Parliament are weighing up, that even if a new leader comes in, will he be able to manage all the crises that we are facing that you have quite eloquently listed? The reality is that we have a broken political system here in UK, it appears. And this is becoming very clear with many crises that are on the horizon, which are being faced by the ordinary people. People blame the economic crisis on what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. But the reality is that we've had austerity for the last 12 years, since the last financial crisis back in 2008-2009. That austerity measures which have been applied really by the Conservatives, they've been in power for the whole of that period. So they can't shy away and say that, you know, it's the Labour baggage that has inflicted pain on the society and on the economy. Okay. It's the Conservative policies.
Let me jump in. I'm sorry to get McNabb here. Final answer here. If you can, under a minute, please, McNabb here. To do the honourable thing, to put the interests of the nation before his own interests, is what the MPs are saying. Do you think that Prime Minister Johnson should resign?
Look, everybody, even his friends, know that honourable and Boris Johnson do not go together. The language that his Conservative Party members are using to describe him is very strong. He's a scoundrel. He's a rascal. He's a liar. And they voted for him because he gave them an 80-seat majority. He managed to sell Brexit and get a huge parliamentary majority.
Okay.
But now he's turned into a fantastic liability. And in terms of confronting the situation of real war, of real massive strikes by railway workers and health workers and teachers, he is not the man to lead the Tory
Party.
Well,
I got to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. It went by so quick. Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. Thank you. And Shabir Rizvi, economic analyst from London. Good luck to you all, since you're all in the UK. Thank you so much for your input, both of you. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Itawe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There is a real risk that multiple famines will be declared in 2022, said Secretary General Antonio Guterres, adding, and 2023 could be even worse. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, UN Chief Warns of Impending Unprecedented Global Food Crisis. Stay tuned for more. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for debt relief for the world's poorest countries recently, as he warned that an unprecedented global food crisis that is already ravaging more vulnerable nations will also have severe impacts for the entire world. The UN chief said the crisis in Eastern Europe has significantly worsened disruptions to the food supply chain that had already been hard hit by the droughts and extreme weather triggered by climate crisis, as well as the coronavirus pandemic and persistent inequality. With farmers across Ukraine unable to harvest wheat due to the crisis, and countries across Europe and Central Asia relying on Russian fertilizer exports, the conflict has already caused a food access crisis that is crushing hundreds of millions of people in the global south. There is a real risk that multiple famines will be declared in 2022, said Guterres in an address to the UN ministerial conference, adding, and 2023 could be even worse. With fertilizer and energy prices rising, he said, all harvests will be hit, including rice and corn, affecting billions of people across Asia, Africa, and the Americas. Guterres added, this year's food access issues could become next year's global food shortage. No country will be immune to the social and economic repercussions of such a catastrophe. The Secretary General's remarks came one day after UNICEF called for $1.2 billion in humanitarian aid from the G7 countries to meet the urgent needs of 8 million children at risk of death from severe wasting, which happens when children are too thin for their height, the most visible and lethal form of undernutrition. The crisis is most severe in 15 mainly African nations such as Burkina Faso, Chad, Kenya, Somalia and Sudan, but also Afghanistan and Haiti, said the agency. According to UNICEF, the global food crisis is pushing one child per minute into severe malnutrition. The UN chief noted recently that international negotiations are currently taking place regarding a deal that would enable Ukraine to export food not only by land but through the Black Sea and bring Russian food and fertilizer to world markets without restrictions. In addition, he said, developed countries and international financial institutions need to make resources available to help governments support and invest in their people, leaving no one behind. Developing countries that face debt default must have access to effective debt relief to keep their economies afloat and their people thriving, said Guterres. He added, we cannot accept mass hunger and starvation in the 21st century.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.